But what could have been more laden with promises than the slogans of the committees of the poor? And what could have been more loaded with threats than the machine guns of the special purpose detachments, the CHON? And how many wholly random people, completely random, whose destruction inevitably accounts for half the casualties of every real shooting revolution, were caught between those millstones? Here is an eyewitness description of a session of the Ryazan Rev Tribunal, which met in 1919 to hear the case of the Tolstoyan I.Y.E. blank V. With the proclamation of universal and compulsory conscription into the Red Army, just 1 year after the slogans, "Down with the War," "Stick your bayonets in the ground," "Go home," 54,697 deserters were caught and sent to the front by September 1919 in Ryazan province alone. And how many others were shot on the spot as examples? Y.E. blank V was not a deserter at all, but a man who simply and openly refused to enter military service because of his religious convictions. He was conscripted by main force, but in the barracks he refused to take up arms or undergo training. The enraged political commissar of the unit turned him over to the Cheka, saying, "He does not recognize the Soviet government." There was an interrogation. 3 Chekists sat behind the desk, each with a Naguan revolver in front of him. "We have seen heroes like you before. You'll be on your knees to us in a minute. Either agree to fight immediately or we'll shoot you." But Y.E. blank V was firm. He couldn't fight. He was a believer in free Christianity. And his case was sent to the Rev Tribunal. It was an open session with 100 spectators in the hall. There was a polite elderly defense lawyer. The learned accuser, the term prosecutor was forbidden until 1922, was Nikolsky, another old jurist. One of the members of the Rev Tribunal, a juror, tried to elicit the views of the accused. How can you, a representative of the working people, share the opinions of the aristocrat Count Tolstoy? But the presiding judge interrupted the questioning and refused to permit it to continue. There was a quarrel. Juror: "You do not want to kill people, and you try to persuade others to refrain from killing. But the whites began the war, and you are preventing us from defending ourselves. We will send you to Kolchak, and you can preach your non-resistance there." Y.E. blank V: "I will go wherever you send me." Accuser: "This tribunal is not supposed to concern itself with any nondescript criminal actions, but only with those which are counter-revolutionary. In view of the nature of this crime, I demand that the case be turned over to a people's court." Presiding judge: "Ha! Actions! What a pettifogger you are! We are guided not by the laws, but by our revolutionary conscience." Accuser: "I insist that you include my demand in the record." Defense attorney: "I support the accuser. The case should be heard in an ordinary court." Presiding judge: "There's an old fool for you. Where did they manage to find him?" Defense attorney: "I have been a practicing lawyer for 40 years, and this is the first time I have heard such an insult. Enter it in the record." Presiding judge, laughing: "We'll enter it, we'll enter it." Laughter in the hall. The court exits in order to confer. The sounds of a noisy argument come from the conference room. They return with the sentence: "To be shot." Loud indignation in the hall. Accuser: "I protest against the sentence and will complain to the Commissariat of Justice." Defense lawyer: "I join my voice to that of the accuser." Presiding judge: "Clear the hall." The convoy came and led Y.E. blank V to jail, saying to him, "If everyone was like you, brother, how good it would be. There would be no war, and no whites and no reds." They went back to their barracks and called a Red Army meeting. It condemned the sentence and sent a protest to Moscow. In daily expectation of death, Y.E. blank V waited for 37 days while, from the prison window, he watched executions taking place. They commuted his sentence to 15 years of strict detention. This is an instructive example. Although revolutionary legality won a partial victory, how enormous an effort it required on the part of the presiding judge. How much disorganization, lack of discipline, lack of political consciousness there still was. The prosecution stood firmly with the defense. The convoy guard stuck their noses into something that wasn't their business in order to send off a protest. Phew, the dictatorship of the proletariat and the new kind of court were not having things easy by any means. Of course, not all the sessions were anything like so turbulent, but this wasn't the only one of its kind. How many years it would take to reveal, direct, and confirm the necessary line until the defense would stand as one with the prosecution and the court, and the accused would be in agreement with them too, and all the resolutions of the workers as well. To pursue this enterprise of many years' duration is the rewarding task of the historian. As for us, how are we to make our way through that rosy mist? Whom are we to ask about it? Those who were shot aren't talking, and neither are those who have been scattered to the four winds. Even if the defendants, and the lawyers, and the guards, and the spectators have survived, no one will allow us to seek them out. Evidently, the only help we will get is from the prosecution. In this connection, I was given by well-wishers an intact copy of a collection of speeches for the prosecution, delivered by that fierce revolutionary, the First People's Commissar of Military Affairs in the Workers' and Peasants' Government, the Commander-in-Chief, and later the organizer of the Department of Exceptional Courts of the People's Commissariat of Justice, where the personal rank of tribune was being readied for him, until Lenin vetoed the title. Lenin, 5th edition, volume 36, page 210. The glorious accuser in the greatest trials, subsequently exposed as the ferocious enemy of the people, N.V. Krylenko. Krylenko, Za Piat Let, 1918-1922, edition 7,000 copies, prosecution speeches in the most important trials held before the Moscow and the Supreme Revolutionary Tribunals. And if, despite everything, we want to attempt a brief review of the public trials, if we are determined to try to get a feeling for the judicial atmosphere of the first post-revolutionary years, then we have to learn to read this Krylenko text. We have no other. And using it as a basis, we must try to picture to ourselves everything that is missing from it, and everything that happened in the provinces too. Of course, we would prefer to see the stenographic record of those trials, to listen to the dramatic voices from beyond the grave of those first defendants and those first lawyers, speaking at a time when no one could have foreseen in what implacable sequence all of it would be swallowed up, together with those Rev Tribunal members as well. However, as Krylenko has explained, for a whole series of technical reasons, it was inconvenient to publish the stenographic records. It was convenient only to publish his speeches for the prosecution and the sentences handed down by the tribunals, which by that time had already come to jibe completely with the demands of the accuser-prosecutor. Krylenko claims that the archives of the Moscow Rev Tribunal and the Supreme Rev Tribunal turned out, by 1922, to be far from orderly. In a whole series of cases, the stenographic records were so incomprehensible that it was necessary either to cross out entire pages or else to try to restore the text from memory. And a series of the biggest trials, including the trial which followed the revolt of the left SRs and the case of Admiral Shchastny, were conducted entirely without stenographic records. This is strange. The condemnation of the left SRs was not a trivial matter. It was, after the February and October revolutions, the third turning point in our history, signalling the transition to a one-party system in the state. Not a few of them were shot, and no stenographic record was made. And the military plot of 1919 was liquidated by the Cheka in an extrajudicial reprisal, which was further proof of its existence. In this case, more than 1,000 people were arrested altogether, and really, how could trials have been set up for them all? So just try to produce a neat, orderly report on the trials of those years. Nevertheless, we can learn the important principles involved in them. For example, the Supreme Accuser, in other words, the Prosecutor General, informs us that the All-Russian Central Executive Committee had the right to intervene in any judicial proceeding. VTSIK pardons and punishes at its own discretion without any limitation whatever. For example, a six-month sentence was changed to 10 years, and as the reader understands, it was not necessary for the entire All-Russian Central Executive Committee to assemble at a plenary meeting to this end, since its chairman, Sverdlov, for example, could correct a sentence without leaving his office. All of this, Krylenko explains, shows the superiority of our system over the false theory of the separation of powers. That is, the theory of the independence of the judiciary. True, Sverdlov also said, it is very good that the legislative and executive power are not divided by a thick wall as they are in the West. All problems can be decided quickly, especially on the phone. Krylenko formulated even more frankly and precisely the general tasks of the Soviet courts in his speeches before those tribunals, when the court was, at one and the same time, both the creator of the law, Krylenko's italics, and a political weapon, my italics. Creator of the law, because for 4 years there were no codes. They had thrown out the Tsarist codes, and they had not composed their own. Don't tell me our criminal courts ought to act exclusively on the basis of existing written norms. We live in the process of revolution. A tribunal is not the kind of court in which fine points of jurisprudence and clever stratagems are to be restored. We are creating a new law and new ethical norms. And also, no matter how much is said here about the eternal law of truth, justice, etc., we know how dearly these have cost us. But if your prison terms are compared with ours, maybe it didn't cost you so dearly after all. Maybe eternal justice was somewhat more comfortable. The reason that fine points of jurisprudence are unnecessary is that there is no need to clarify whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty. The concept of guilt is an old bourgeois concept which has now been uprooted. And so we have heard from Comrade Krylenko that a tribunal was not that kind of court. On another occasion, we would hear from him that a tribunal was not a court at all. A tribunal is an organ of the class struggle of the workers directed against their enemies, and must act from the point of view of the interests of the revolution, having in mind the most desirable results for the masses of workers and peasants. People are not people, but carriers of specific ideas. No matter what the individual qualities of the defendant, only one method of evaluating him is to be applied, evaluation from the point of view of class expediency. In other words, you can exist only if it's expedient for the working class, and if this expediency should require that the avenging sword should fall on the head of the defendants, then no verbal arguments can help, such as arguments by lawyers, etc. In our revolutionary court, we are guided not by articles of the law and not by the degree of extenuating circumstances. In the tribunal, we must proceed on the basis of considerations of expediency. That was the way it was in those years. People lived and breathed and then suddenly found out that their existence was inexpedient. And it must also be kept in mind that it was not what he had done that constituted the defendant's burden, but what he might do if he were not shot now. We protect ourselves not only against the past, but also against the future. Comrade Krylenko's pronouncements are clear and all-inclusive. They bring alive for us that whole period of the law in sharp relief. The clarity of autumn suddenly pierces the mists of spring and reaches us. And is it perhaps unnecessary to go further? Perhaps we aren't required to page through trial after trial. These pronouncements will be henceforth inexorably applied. Close your eyes tight for a minute and picture a tiny courtroom, not yet gilded. Earnest members of the tribunal in simple field jackets, lean, not yet fat-faced. The accusing power, as Krylenko loved to style himself, wears an unbuttoned civilian jacket with a glimpse of a sailor's striped undershirt just visible at the open throat. The supreme accuser expresses himself in this sort of language. The question of fact is interesting to me. Define concretely the aspect of the tendency. We are operating on the plane of analysis of objective truth. Sometimes, as you read, a quotation from the Latin shines out. It is true that the same quotation turns up in case after case, but after several years a different one does appear. And no wonder. He did, after all, complete the course in two faculties despite all his revolutionary running around. What attracts one to him are his frank opinions about the defendants. Professional scoundrels! And he isn't hypocritical in the least. If he didn't like the defendant's smile, he didn't hesitate to blurt out a threat, even before any sentence was imposed. And as for you and your smile, Citizeness Ivanova, we'll make you pay for it, and we'll find a way to fix it so that you never laugh again. So, shall we begin? A. The case of Ruskiye Vedomosti. In this case, one of the earliest, free speech, was on trial. On March the 24th, 1918, this famous professorial newspaper published an article by Savinkov entitled En Route. They would have much preferred to arrest Savinkov himself, but he really was en route, damn it, and where was he to be found? So instead they closed down the paper and brought the elderly editor, P.V. Yegorov, to court as a defendant, insisting that he explain how he had dared to publish the article. After all, the new era was 4 months old, and it was time to get used to it. Yegorov naively defended himself by saying that the article had been written by a leading political figure whose opinion was of general interest, whether or not the editors shared it. Furthermore, he saw nothing slanderous in Savinkov's having said, "Let us not forget that Lenin, Natanson, and company arrived in Russia via Berlin." That is, that the German authorities helped them return to the homeland. Because that, in actual fact, was what had happened. Kaiser Wilhelm's embattled Germany had helped Comrade Lenin to return. Krylenko retorted that he would not conduct a prosecution for slander. Why not? And that the newspaper was on trial for attempting to influence people's minds. And how could any newspaper dare have such a purpose? The formal charge did not include Savinkov's phrase, "One has to be criminally insane to affirm seriously that the international proletariat will come to our aid," because it still would come to our aid. For attempting to influence people's minds, the newspaper, which had been published since 1864 and had survived the most fiercely reactionary periods, those of Loris Melikov, Povedonetsov, Stolypin, Kasso, and all the rest, was ordered closed down forever. And Yegorov, the editor, and this is a shameful thing to have to say, was given only 3 months of solitary, just as though we were in Greece or some such place. It is not so shamefully lenient, however, if one stops to think that it was only 1918, and if the old man managed to survive, he would be imprisoned again, and many more times too. It may seem strange to us now, but it is a fact that in those thunderous years, bribes were given and taken just as tenderly as they had been from time immemorial in old Russia, and as they will be in the Soviet Union from here to eternity. Bribery was particularly rife in the judicial organs, and though we blush to say it, in the Cheka. The official histories in their red, gold-stamped bindings are silent about this, but the old folks and eyewitnesses remember that the fate of political prisoners in the first years of the revolution, as distinct from Stalinist times, often depended on bribes. They were accepted uninhibitedly, and prisoners were honestly released as a result. Although Krylenko picked out only a dozen cases for the five-year period his book covers, he reports 2 cases of bribery. Alas, even the Moscow Tribunal and the Supreme Tribunal squeezed their way through to perfection along a crooked path, muddied themselves in improprieties. B. The case of the 3 interrogators of the Moscow Rev Tribunal, April 1918. In March 1918, a speculator in gold bars named Berije was arrested. His wife tried to find a way to ransom her husband, which was the accepted thing to do. Through a series of connections, she succeeded in getting to one of the interrogators, who brought 2 others in with him. Meeting secretly, they demanded a bribe of 250,000 rubles, but after some bargaining, they reduced it to 60,000, half in advance. The deal was to be made through the lawyer Grin. Everything would have gone off without a fuss, as hundreds of similar deals had, and the case would have gotten into neither Krylenko's chronicle nor ours, nor even become a matter of concern to the Council of People's Commissars, had it not been that Berije's wife began to get miserly, and brought Green only 15,000 as an advance payment, instead of 30,000. But the main thing was that, in consequence of female fickleness, she changed her mind overnight, decided her lawyer wasn't good enough for her, and went off the next morning to find another, the attorney Yakulov. It is not stated anywhere, but it was evidently Yakulov who decided to turn in the interrogators. It is of interest that all the witnesses in this trial, beginning with the unfortunate wife, tried to give testimony helpful to the accused and to befuddle the prosecution, which would have been impossible in a political trial. Krylenko explained their conduct as the result of a narrow-minded Philistine attitude, because they felt like outsiders as far as the Rev Tribunal was concerned. And might we ourselves be so audacious as to advance the Philistine hypothesis that in the course of a year and a half the witnesses had already learned to be afraid of the dictatorship of the proletariat? After all, it took a lot of nerve to turn in the interrogators of the Rev Tribunal. What would happen to you after that? The accuser's line of argument is also of interest. After all, just a month earlier, the defendants had been his associates, his comrades in arms, his assistants. They were people who had been inalienably dedicated to the interests of the revolution. And one of them, Liszt, was even a stern accuser, capable of hurling thunder and lightning at anyone who attacked the foundations. What was he to say about them now? Where was he to look for the causes of their fall? A bribe was not enough in itself. And, of course, it is clear where he looked, in their pasts, in their biographies. Declared Krylenko, "If we look closely at this Liszt, we will find highly interesting information." This is intriguing. Was he an inveterate adventurer? No, but he was the son of a professor at Moscow University, and not an ordinary professor, but one who had survived 20 years of reaction by his indifference to political activity, and who, notwithstanding that reaction, had been accepted by Krylenko as a consultant. Was it surprising, then, that the son turned out to be a double dealer? As for Podgaisky, he was the son of an official in the law courts, beyond doubt one of the reactionary pogrom-organizing Black Hundreds. Otherwise, how could he have served the Tsar for 20 years? And the son, too, had prepared for a career in the law courts, but then the revolution had come, and he had wormed his way into the Rev Tribunal. Just yesterday all this had been depicted in a very favourable light, but it had suddenly become repulsive. More repulsive than them both was, of course, Gugel. He had been a publisher, and what intellectual food had he been offering the workers and peasants? He was nourishing the broad masses with low-quality literature. Not Marx, but instead books by bourgeois professors with world-famous names. And we shall soon encounter these professors as defendants, too. Krylenko is enraged and marvels at the kind of people who have sneaked into the tribunal. Neither do we understand what kind of people are the workers' and peasants' tribunals composed of. Why had the proletariat entrusted the task of striking down their enemies to people of this particular kind? And as for Green, the lawyer, a man with an in on the investigating commission, who was quite able to get anybody off scot-free, he was a typical representative of that sub-species of the human race which Marx called leeches on the capitalist structure, a category including, in addition, all lawyers, gendarmes, priests, and also notaries. It appears that Krylenko spared no effort in demanding mercilessly severe sentences without reference to the individual shadings of guilt. But some kind of lethargy, some sort of torpor, overcame the eternally vigorous tribunal, and it just barely managed to mumble 6 months in jail for the interrogators and a fine for the lawyer. And only by availing himself of the authority of the All-Russian Central Executive Committee to punish without limitation did Krylenko, there in the metropole, continue to hang 10-year sentences on the interrogators and 5 on the lawyer, plus full confiscation of his property. Krylenko thundered on about vigilance, and he almost managed, but not quite, to get the title of tribune he so coveted. We recognize that among the revolutionary masses at the time, as among our readers today, this unfortunate trial could not but undermine faith in the sanctity of the tribunal, and we therefore proceed with even greater timidity to the next case, which concerns an even loftier institution. C. The case of Kozyrev, February 15, 1919. F. M. Kozyrev and his pals Libet, Rottenberg, and Soloviev had first served on the Commission for Supply of the Eastern Front, back before Kolchak, when the enemy forces were the armies of the Constituent Assembly. It was discovered that there they had found ways to siphon into their own pockets from 70,000 to 1,000,000 rubles at a time. They rode around on fine horses and engaged in orgies with the nurses. Their commission had acquired a house and an automobile, and their majordomo lived it up in the Yar restaurant. We aren't accustomed to picturing 1918 in this light, but all this was in the testimony of the Rev Tribunal. But none of this, to be sure, was the case against them. No charge had been brought against any of them in connection with their activities on the Eastern Front. They had even been forgiven all that. But, wonder of wonders, hardly had their commission for supply been disbanded than all four of them, with the addition of Nazarenko, a former Siberian tramp and convict pal of Kozyrev in criminal hard labor, were invited to constitute the Control and Auditing Collegium of the VCHK, the Cheka. Here's what this collegium was. It had plenipotentiary powers to verify the legality of the actions of all the remaining organs of the Cheka, the right to demand and review any case at any stage of its processing, and to reverse the decisions of all the remaining organs of the VCHK, excepting only the Presidium of the Cheka. This was no small thing. This collegium was second in command in the Cheka after the Presidium itself. It ranked immediately below Jasinski, Uritsky, Peters, Latsis, Menzhinsky, Yogoda. The way of life of this comradely group remained just what it had been before. They didn't get swelled heads. They didn't get carried away. With certain individuals named Maximich, Lenka, Rafaelsky, and Mariupolsky, who had no connection at all with the Communist Party, they set up, in private apartments and in the Hotel Savoy, lavish establishments where card games with table stakes as high as 1,000 rubles a throw were the order of the day, along with heavy drinking and women. Kozyrev acquired a rich establishment of his own, costing 70,000 rubles, and in fact did not even draw the line at hauling off silver spoons and goblets and even ordinary glassware from the Cheka. And how did all these objects get to the Cheka? And this was where his attention was concentrated, rather than in the direction of ideas and ideology, and this was what he took from the revolutionary movement. In the very act of repudiating the bribes he had accepted, this leading Chekist, without blinking, volunteered the lie that he possessed 200,000 rubles from an inheritance in a Chicago bank. Evidently, as far as he was concerned, there was no conflict between such a circumstance and world revolution. Now, how did he propose to make proper use of his superhuman right to arrest anyone at all and release anyone at all? Clearly, one had to find a fish with golden roe, and in 1918 there were not a few such fish in the nets. After all, the revolution had been carried out too quickly. They hadn't found everything. How many precious stones, necklaces, bracelets, rings, and earrings the bourgeois ladies had managed to hide away? Then one had to make contact with the relatives of those who had been arrested through some reliable middleman. Such characters also passed before us at the trial. There was Uspenskaya, a woman of 22. She had graduated from the St. Petersburg Gymnasium, but hadn't gone on to the university. The Soviets had come to power. And so, in the spring of 1918, Uspenskaya appeared at the Cheka to offer her services as an informer. She qualified on the basis of her appearance, and they accepted her. Krylenko has this to say about informing, which in those days had a different label. For ourselves, we see nothing shameful in it. We consider this to be our duty. The work itself is not disgraceful. Once a person admits that this work is necessary in the interests of the revolution, then he must do it. But alas, it turned out that Uspenskaya had no political credo. That's what was awful. She declared, "I agreed in order to be paid a fixed percentage on the cases which were turned up, and beyond that, to split 50-50 with someone else, whom the court protected and instructed her not to identify. Krylenko put it in his own words. Uspenskaya was not a staff member of the Cheka, but worked at peace rates. And incidentally, the accuser, understanding her in a very human way, explains that she had grown used to having plenty of money, and that her insignificant salary of 500 rubles from the Supreme Council of the Economy was nothing at all, considering that one exercise in extortion, for example, helping a merchant to get the seal removed from his store, would net her 5,000 rubles, and another, from Meshcheskaya Greves, wife of a prisoner, would bring in 17,000. For that matter, Uspenskaya served only briefly as a mere stool pigeon. Thanks to the help of certain big Chekists, in a few months she became a member of the Communist Party and an interrogator. However, we don't seem to be getting to the essence of the case. Uspenskaya had arranged a meeting between this Meshcheskaya Greves and a certain Godelyuk, a bosom pal of Kosirev, in order to reach an agreement on her husband's ransom. They had initially demanded 600,000 rubles. But unfortunately, by some still unexplained means, the arrangements for that secret meeting became known to the same attorney, Yakulov, who had already done in the three bribe-taking interrogators, and who evidently felt a class hatred for the whole proletarian system of judicial and extrajudicial processing. Yakulov denounced them to the Moscow Rev Tribunal, and the presiding judge of the tribunal, recalling perhaps the wrath of the Council of People's Commissars in connection with the three interrogators, also blundered in terms of class premises. In order to temper the reader's indignation against this leech-like snake, Yakulov, we should point out that by the time of Kosirev's trial, he had already been arrested and was in custody. They had found a case to take care of him. He was brought in to testify, accompanied by convoy, and we are certainly entitled to hope that he was shot soon afterward. Today we are surprised. How did things reach such a pitch of illegality? Why did no one mount an offensive against it? Instead of simply warning Comrade Dzerzhinsky and working it all out in the family, he hid a stenographer behind the curtain, and the stenographer took down all Godelyuk's references to Kosirev, and to Soloviev, and to other commissars, and all his stories about who in the Cheka takes how many thousands. Then, as per the stenographic record, Godelyuk received an advance payment of 12,000 rubles, and Meshcheskaya Greves was given a pass to enter the Cheka that had already been filled out by the Control and Auditing Collegium, by Libert and Rottenberg. The bargaining was to continue there, inside the Cheka. Then and there, Godelyuk was caught. In his confusion, he gave testimony against them. And Meshcheskaya Greves had already gotten to the Control and Auditing Collegium, and they had already ordered her husband's case transferred there for verification. But just a moment. After all, an expose like this sullies the heavenly blue uniforms of the Cheka. Was the presiding judge of the Moscow Rev Tribunal in his right mind? Was he really tending to his own business? But it turns out that that was the nature of the moment, a moment totally hidden from us in the folds of our majestic history. It seems that the Cheka's first year of work had produced a somewhat repellent impression even on the party of the proletariat, which still hadn't gotten used to it. Only its first year had passed. The Cheka had taken only the first step on its glorious path. And already, as Krylenko writes, although not very clearly, a dispute had arisen between the court and its functions and the extrajudicial functions of the Cheka, a dispute which at the time split the party and the workers' districts into two camps. And that is how the Kosirev case could come up, whereas everything had gone smoothly before, and reach all the way up to the topmost level of the whole state apparatus. The Cheka had to be saved. Help! Save the Cheka! Soloviev asked the tribunal to allow him inside the Taganka prison to visit Godelyuk, who, alas, was not in the Lubyanka, so as to chat with him. The tribunal declined the request. Then Soloviev managed to penetrate into Godelyuk's cell without the help of any tribunal, and, what a coincidence, at that very point, Godelyuk became seriously ill. "One can hardly speak of evil intentions on Soloviev's part," Krylenko bows and scrapes. Feeling the approach of death, Gordeliuk shakily repented having slandered the checker and asked for a sheet of paper on which to write his recantation. It was all untrue. He had slandered Kosirev and the other commissars of the checker, and everything the stenographer had taken down behind the curtain was also untrue. Oh, how many themes we have here. Oh, where is Shakespeare? Soloviev passes through the walls, flickering shadows in the cell. Gordeliuk recants with failing hand, and all we hear about the years of the revolution in our plays and our films is the street singing of hostile whirlwinds. "And who filled out the passes for Meshcherskaya Greves?" Krylenko insisted. They hadn't materialized out of thin air, certainly. "No," the chief accuser does not wish to say that Soloviev was an accessory in this case because there is insufficient evidence. But he advances the hypothesis that citizens still at liberty who were in danger of being caught with their hands in the till might have sent Soloviev to the Taganka jail. This was the perfect time to question Liebert and Rottenberg, and they were subpoenaed, but they didn't appear. Just like that. They didn't show up. They declined to. All right, in that case, question Meshcherskaya Greves. And, can you imagine it? This broken-down aristocrat, too, was so brazen as not to appear before the Rev Tribunal. And there was no way to force her to. Gordeliuk had recanted and was dying. Kosirev refused to admit anything. Soloviev was not guilty of anything. So there was no one to question. What witnesses, on the other hand, did indeed appear before the tribunal, and of their own free will? The deputy chief of the checker, Comrade Peters, and even Felix Edmundovich Dzerzhinsky himself. He arrived in a state of alarm. His long, burning, zealot's face confronted the tribunal, whose members sat with sinking hearts, and he testified passionately in defense of the totally innocent Kosirev and his high moral, revolutionary, and professional qualities. This testimony, alas, has not been preserved for us, but Krylenko refers to it this way. Soloviev and Dzerzhinsky portrayed Kosirev's wonderful qualities. Alas, you careless shave-tail, you. In 20 years' time in the Lubyanka, they are going to remind you of that trial. It is easy to guess what Dzerzhinsky could have said, that Kosirev was an iron checkist, merciless to their enemies, that he was a good comrade, a hot heart, a cool head, clean hands. And from the garbage heap of slander, the bronze knight Kosirev rises before our eyes. Furthermore, his whole biography testifies to his remarkable will. Before the revolution, he was convicted several times, most often for murder. In the city of Kostroma, he was convicted of worming his way by deception into the house of an old woman named Smirnova and strangling her with his own hands. Then of an attempt to kill his own father, and then of killing a comrade in order to use his passport. The rest of Kosirev's convictions were for swindling, and in all he spent many years at hard labor. One could understand his desire for a luxurious life. And he had only been freed by the Tsarist amnesties. At that point, the stern and righteous voices of the major Chekists interrupted the chief accuser. They pointed out to him that those courts which had convicted Kosirev were courts of the bourgeoisie and landowners and did not merit being noticed in our new society. But what happened? The shave-tail, going overboard, poured forth from the chief accuser's rostrum a tirade so ideologically faulty that in our exposition of this harmonious series of cases tried by the tribunals, citing it is to strike a discordant note. If there was anything good in the old Tsarist court system, it was only trial by jury. One could always have confidence in the jurors' decisions, and a minimum of judicial error was to be found in them. It was all the more vexing to hear this sort of thing from Comrade Krylenko, because just 3 months before, at the trial of the provocateur R. Malinovsky, a former favorite of the Communist Party leadership, who, notwithstanding his 4 criminal convictions in the past, had been co-opted into the Central Committee by the leadership and appointed to the Duma, the accusing power had taken an impeccable class stand. Every crime is the result of a given social system, and in these terms criminal convictions under the laws of a capitalist society and in Tsarist times do not, in our eyes, constitute a fact branding a person with an indelible mark once and for all. We know of many examples of persons in our ranks branded by such facts in the past, but we have never drawn the conclusion that it was necessary to remove such a person from our milieu. A person who knows our principles cannot fear that the existence of previous criminal convictions in his record will jeopardize his being included in the ranks of the revolutionaries. That is how Comrade Krylenko could speak when in a party vein. But in this other case, as a result of his mistaken judgment, the image of the knight in shining armor, Kosirev, was being bespattered. And it created a situation in the tribunal wherein Comrade Dzerzhinsky was forced to say, "For just one second, the thought crossed my mind that citizen Kosirev might be falling victim to the political passions which in recent times have blazed up around the extraordinary commission." And Krylenko suddenly took thought. "I do not wish, and I never have wished, that the present trial should turn into a trial of the Cheka rather than a trial of Kosirev and Ouspenskaya. Not only am I unable to desire such an outcome, I am obliged to fight against it with all available means." And he went on. "The most responsible, honest, and self-controlled comrades were put at the head of the extraordinary commission, and they took on themselves the difficult task of striking down the enemy, even though this involved the risk of error. For this the revolution is obliged to say thank you. I underline this aspect so that no one can ever say to me later, 'He turned out to be an instrument of political treason.' But that's what they will say." What a razor edge the supreme accuser was walking. But he evidently had certain contacts going back to his days in the underground, through which he learned how things were going to move on the morrow. This is conspicuous in several trials, and came out here too. At the beginning of 1919, there were certain trends toward saying, "It is enough, it is time to bridle the Cheka." And this moment was beautifully caught in Bukharin's essay, in which he said that revolutionary legality must give way to legalized revolutionality. Wherever you look, you see dialectics. And Krylenko burst out, "The Rev Tribunal is being called on to replace the Extraordinary Commission." "To replace?" "Meanwhile, it must be no less fierce in implementing the system of terror, intimidation, and threat than was the Extraordinary Commission, the Cheka." "Than it was? The past tense. Has he already buried it? Come now, you are going to replace it, and where are the Chekists supposed to go?" Ominous days. That was reason enough to hurry to the tribunal, in a greatcoat down to one's heels, to testify as a witness. "But perhaps your sources of information, Comrade Krylenko, are false." "Yes, the heavens darkened over the Lubyanka in those days, and this whole book might have been very different. But I suppose that what happened was that Ion Felix Dzerzhinsky went to see Vladimir Ilyich Lenin and talked it over and explained, and the skies cleared. And although 2 days later, on February the 17th, 1919, the Cheka was deprived of its judicial rights by special decree of the All-Russian Central Executive Committee, it was not for long. Our day in court was further complicated by the fact that the objectionable Ouspenskaya behaved abominably. From the defendant's bench, she threw mud at leading Chekists who had not previously been touched by the trial, including Comrade Peters. She turned out to have used his pure name in her blackmailing operations. She used to sit right in his office without any ceremony during his conversations with other intelligence agents. Now, she hinted, at some dark pre-revolutionary past of his in Riga. That's the kind of snake she had turned into in 8 months, despite the fact that she had been with Chekists during those 8 months. What was to be done with such a woman? Here, Krylenko's position jibed completely with that of the Chekists. "Until a firm regime has been established, and we are a long way from that being the case..." "Are we really?" "In the interests of the defense of the revolution, there is not and cannot be any sentence for citizeness Ouspenskaya other than her annihilation." He did not say, "to be shot." What he said was, "annihilation." "But after all, citizen Krylenko, she's just a young girl. Come on now, give her a tenner, or maybe a 25, and maybe the system will be firmly established by then. How about it? But alas, in the interests of society and of the revolution, there is no other answer, nor can there be one, and the question cannot be put any other way. In the given case, detention isn't going to bear any fruit. She had sure rubbed the salt in. She knew too much. And Kosirev had to be sacrificed, too. They shot him. It was for the health of the others. Can it really be that some day we will read the old Lubyanka archives? No, they will burn them. They already have. As the reader can see for himself, this was a very unimportant case. We didn't have to dwell on it. But here is a different one. D. The case of the churchmen. January the 11th to 16th, 1920. This case, in Krylenko's opinion, is going to have a suitable place in the annals of the Russian Revolution. Right there in the annals, indeed. It took one day to wring Kosirev's neck, but in this case they dragged things out for 5 whole days. The principal defendants were A.D. Samarin, a famous man in Russia, the former chief procurator of the Synod, a man who had tried to liberate the church from the Tsar's yoke, an enemy of Rasputin, whom Rasputin had forced out of office. But accuser Krylenko saw no difference whatever between Samarin and Rasputin. Kuznetsov, professor of church law at Moscow University, the Moscow archpriests Uspensky and Svetkov. The accuser himself had this to say about Svetkov: an important public figure, perhaps the best that the clergy could produce, a philanthropist. Their guilt lay in creating the Moscow Council of United Parishes, which had in turn recruited, from among believers 40 to 80 years old, a voluntary guard for the patriarch, unarmed, of course, which had set up permanent day and night watches in his residence, who were charged with the responsibility, in the event of danger from the authorities to the patriarch, of assembling the people by ringing the church alarm bells and by telephone, so that a whole crowd might follow wherever the patriarch might be taken, and beg, and there's your counter-revolution for you, the Council of People's Commissars to release him. What an ancient Russian, holy Russian, scheme. To assemble the people by ringing the alarm bells, and proceed in a crowd with a petition. And the accuser was astonished. What danger threatened the patriarch? Why had plans been made to defend him? Well, of course, it was really no more than the fact that the Cheka had for 2 years been conducting extrajudicial reprisals against undesirables, the fact that only a short while before 4 Red Army men in Kiev had killed the Metropolitan, the fact that the Patriarch's case had already been worked up and completed, and all that remained was to bring it before the Rev Tribunal, and it was only out of concern for the broad masses of workers and peasants, still under the influence of clerical propaganda, that we have left these, our class enemies, alone for the time being. How could Orthodox believers possibly be alarmed on the Patriarch's account? During those 2 years, Patriarch Tikhon had refused to keep silent. He had sent messages to the people's commissars, to the clergy, and to his flock. His messages were not accepted by the printers, but were copied on typewriters, the first samizdat. They exposed the annihilation of the innocents, the ruin of the country. How, therefore, could anyone really be concerned for the patriarch's life? A second charge was brought against the defendants. Throughout the country, a census and requisition of church property was taking place. This was in addition to the closing of monasteries and the expropriation of church lands and properties. In question here were liturgical vessels, cups, and candelabra. And the Council of Parishes had disseminated an appeal to believers to resist the requisition, sounding the alarm on the church bell. And that was natural, after all. That, after all, was how they had defended the churches against the Tatars, too. And the third charge against them was their incessant, impudent dispatching of petitions to the Council of People's Commissars for relief from the desecration of the churches by local authorities, from crude blasphemy and violations of the law which guaranteed freedom of conscience. Even though no action was taken on these petitions, according to the testimony of Bonch Brujevich, administrative officer of the Council of People's Commissars, they had discredited the local authorities. Taking into consideration all the violations committed by these defendants, what punishment could the accuser possibly demand for these awful crimes? Will not the reader's revolutionary conscience prompt the answer? To be shot, of course. And that is just what Krylenko did demand for Samarin and Kuznetsov. But while they were fussing around with these damned legal formalities and listening to too many long speeches from too many bourgeois lawyers, speeches which, for technical reasons, we will not cite here, it turned out that capital punishment had been abolished. What a fix. It just couldn't be. What had happened? It developed that Dzerzhinsky had issued this order to the Cheka, without capital punishment. But had it been extended to the tribunals by the Council of People's Commissars? Not yet. Krylenko cheered up. And he continued to demand execution by shooting on the following grounds. Even if we suppose that the consolidation of the Republic has removed the immediacy of threat from such persons, it seems nonetheless indubitable that in this period of creative effort, a purge of the old turncoat leaders is required by revolutionary necessity. And further, Soviet power is proud of the decree of the Cheka abolishing the death penalty. But this still does not force us to conclude that the question of the abolition of capital punishment has been decided once and for all, for the entire period of Soviet rule. That was quite prophetic. Capital punishment would return, and very soon, too. After all, what a long line still remained to be rubbed out. Yes, including Krylenko, too, and many of his class brothers as well. And indeed, the tribunal was submissive and sentenced Samarin and Kuznetsov to be shot. But they did manage to tack on a recommendation for clemency, to be imprisoned in a concentration camp until the final victory over world imperialism. They would still be sitting there today. And as for the best that the clergy could produce, his sentence was 15 years, commuted to 5. Other defendants as well were dragged into this trial in order to add at least a little substance to the charges. Among them were some monks and teachers of Zvenigorod, involved in the Zvenigorod affair in the summer of 1918, but for some reason not brought to trial for a year and a half. Or they might have been, but were now being tried again, since it was expedient. That summer, some Soviet officials had called on Father Superior Ion at the Svenigorod Monastery and ordered him, step lively there, to turn over to them the holy relics of St. Sava. Firkov, a former guards officer of the Tsar's household cavalry, who had suddenly undergone a spiritual conversion, given all his goods to the poor, and entered the monastery, but I do not in fact know whether he actually did distribute his goods to the poor. Yes, and if one admits the possibility of spiritual conversion, what then remains of class theory? The officials not only smoked inside the church, and evidently behind the altar screen as well, and of course refused to take off their caps, but one of them took Sava's skull in his hands, and began to spit into it, to demonstrate that its sanctity was an illusion. And there were further acts of desecration. This led to the alarm bell being sounded, a popular uprising, and the killing of one or two of the officials. The others denied having committed any acts of desecration, including the spitting incident, and Krylenko accepted their denials. But which of us doesn't remember similar scenes? My first memory is of an event that took place when I was probably 3 or 4. The peaked heads, as they call the Czechists in their high-peaked Budeni caps, invaded a Kislovodsk church, sliced through the dumbstruck crowd of worshippers, and in their pointed caps went straight through the altar screen to the altar and stopped the service. Were these officials the ones on trial now? No, the monks. We beg the reader, throughout, to keep in mind. From 1918 on, our judicial custom determined that every Moscow trial, except of course the unjust trial of the Czechists, was by no means an isolated trial of an accidental concatenation of circumstances which had converged by accident. It was a landmark of judicial policy. It was a display window model whose specifications determined what product was good for the provinces too. It was a standard. It was like that one and only model solution up front in the arithmetic book for the schoolchildren to follow for themselves. Thus, when we say the trial of the churchmen, this must be understood in the multiple plural, many trials. And in fact, the supreme accuser himself willingly explains, such trials have rolled along through almost all the tribunals of the Republic. What language! They had taken place not long before in the tribunals in Novodvina, Tver, and Ryazan. In Saratov, Kazan, Ufa, Solvyezhegodsk, and Sarevokokshaysk, trials were held of the clergy, the choirs, and the active members of the congregation, representatives of the ungrateful Orthodox Church liberated by the October Revolution. The reader will be aware of a conflict here. Why did many of these trials occur earlier than the Moscow model? This is simply a shortcoming of our exposition. The judicial and the extrajudicial persecution of the liberated church had begun well back in 1918, and judging by the Zvenigorod affair, it had already reached a peak of intensity by that summer. In October 1918, Patriarch Tikhon had protested in a message to the Council of People's Commissars that there was no freedom to preach in the churches and that many courageous priests have already paid for their preaching with the blood of martyrdom. You have laid your hands on church property collected by generations of believers, and you have not hesitated to violate their posthumous intent. The People's Commissars did not, of course, read the message, but the members of their administrative staff must have had a good laugh. Now they've really got something to reproach us with. Posthumous intent? We shit on your ancestors. We are only interested in descendants. They are executing bishops, priests, monks, and nuns who are guilty of nothing on the basis of indiscriminate charges of indefinite and vaguely counter-revolutionary offences. True, with the approach of Denikin and Kolchak, this was stopped so as to make it easier for Orthodox believers to defend the revolution. But hardly had the civil war begun to die down than they took up their cudgels against the church again, and the cases started rolling through the tribunals once more. In 1920, they struck at the Trinity St. Sergius Monastery and went straight to the holy relics of that chauvinist Sergius of Radonezh and hauled them off to a Moscow museum. The patriarch cited Klyuchevsky. The gates of the monastery of the saint will shut, and the icon lamps will be extinguished over his sepulchre. Only when we shall have lost every vestige of that spiritual and moral strength willed to us by such great builders of the Russian land as St. Sergius. Klyuchevsky did not imagine that the loss would occur almost in his own lifetime. The patriarch asked for an appointment with the chairman of the Council of People's Commissars, in the hope of persuading him not to touch the holy monastery and the relics, for after all, the church was separate from the state. The answer came back that the chairman was occupied in discussing important business and that the appointment could not be arranged for the near future, nor for the distant future either. The People's Commissariat of Justice issued a directive dated August the 25th, 1920, for the liquidation of relics of all kinds, since they were a significant obstacle to the resplendent movement toward a new, just society. Pursuing further Krylenko's own selection of cases, let us also examine the case tried in the Verkhtrib, in other words, the Supreme Tribunal. How affectionately they abbreviated words within their intimate circle, but how they roared out for us little insects, "Rise! The court is in session!" E. The case of the Tactical Center, August the 16th to 20th, 1920. In this case, there were 28 defendants present, plus additional defendants who were being tried in absentia because they weren't around. At the very beginning of his impassioned speech, in a voice not yet grown hoarse and in phrases illumined by class analysis, the supreme accuser informs us that in addition to the landowners and the capitalists, There existed and there continues to exist one additional social stratum, the social characteristics of which have long since been under consideration by the representatives of revolutionary socialism. In other words, to be or not to be. This stratum is the so-called intelligentsia. In this trial, we shall be concerned with the judgment of history on the activity of the Russian intelligentsia and with the verdict of the revolution on it. The narrow limits of our investigation prevent our comprehending exactly the particular manner in which the representatives of revolutionary socialism were taking under consideration the fate of the so-called intelligentsia and what specifically they were planning for it. However, we take comfort in the fact that these materials have been published, that they are accessible to everyone, and that they can be assembled in any required detail. Therefore, solely to understand the overall atmosphere of the Republic, we shall recall the opinion of the chairman of the Council of People's Commissars in the years when all these tribunal sessions were going on. In a letter to Gorky on September the 15th, 1919, which we have already cited, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin replied to Gorky's attempts to intercede in the arrests of members of the intelligentsia, among them, evidently, some of the defendants in this trial, and commenting on the bulk of the Russian intelligentsia of those years, the close-to-the-cadets intelligentsia, he wrote, "In actual fact, they are not the nation's brains, but shit." Lenin, 5th edition, volume 51, page 48. On another occasion, he said to Gorky, "If we break too many pots, it will be its, the intelligentsia's, fault." If the intelligentsia wants justice, why doesn't it come over to us? "I've gotten one bullet from the intelligentsia myself." In other words, from Kaplan. On the basis of these feelings, he expressed his mistrust and hostility toward the intelligentsia, rotten liberal, pious, the slovenliness so customary among educated people. He believed the intelligentsia was always short-sighted, that it had betrayed the cause of the workers. But when had the intelligentsia ever sworn loyalty to the cause of the workers, the dictatorship of the workers? This mockery of the intelligentsia, this contempt for the intelligentsia, was subsequently adopted with enthusiasm by the publicists and the newspapers of the 20s, and was absorbed into the current of day-to-day life. And in the end, the members of the intelligentsia accepted it too, cursing their eternal thoughtlessness, their eternal duality, their eternal spinelessness, and their hopeless lagging behind the times. And this was just. The voice of the accusing power echoed and re-echoed beneath the vaults of the Verkhtrib, returning us to the defendant's bench. "This social stratum has, during recent years, undergone the trial of universal re-evaluation." Yes, yes, re-evaluation, as was so often said at the time. And how did that re-evaluation occur? Here's how. The Russian intelligentsia, which entered the crucible of the revolution with slogans of power for the people, so it had something to it, after all, emerged from it an ally of the black, not even white, generals, and a hired and obedient agent of European imperialism. The intelligentsia trampled on its own banners, as in the army, yes, and covered them with mud. How, indeed, can we not cry out our hearts in repentance? How can we not lacerate our chests with our fingernails? And the only reason why there is no need to deal out the death blow to its individual representatives is that this social group has outlived its time. Here, at the start of the 20th century, what power of foresight! Oh, scientific revolutionaries! However, the intelligentsia had to be finished off anyway. Throughout the 20s, they kept finishing them off and finishing them off. We examine with hostility the 28 individual allies of the black generals, the hirelings of European imperialism, and we are especially aroused by the stench of the word centre. Now we see a tactical centre, now a national centre, and now a right centre. And in our recollection of the trials of two decades, centres keep creeping in all the time, centers and centers, engineers' centers, Menshevik centers, Trotskyite, Zinovievite centers, rightist Bukharinite centers, but all of them are crushed, all crushed, and that is the only reason you and I are still alive. Wherever there is a center, of course, the hand of imperialism can be found. True, we feel a measure of relief when we learn that the tactical center on this occasion was not an organization, that it did not have 1. Statutes, 2. A program, 3. Membership dues. So what did it have? Here's what. They used to meet. Goose pimples up and down the back. And when they met, they undertook to familiarize themselves with one another's point of view. I see chills. The charges were extremely serious and were supported by the evidence. There were 2 pieces of evidence to corroborate the charges against 28 accused individuals. There were 2 letters from people who were not present in court because they were abroad, Mayakotin and Fyodorov. They were absent, but until the October Revolution, they had been members of the same committees as those who were present, a circumstance that gave us the right to equate those who were absent with those who were present. And their letters dealt with their disagreements with Denikin on certain trivial questions. The peasant question, we are not told what these differences were, but they were evidently advising Denikin to give the land to the peasants. The Jewish question, they were evidently advising him not to return to the previous restrictions. The Federated Nationalities question, enough said, clear. The question of the structure of the government, democracy rather than dictatorship, and similar matters. And what conclusion did this evidence suggest? Very simple. It proved the fact of correspondence, and it also proved the agreement, the unanimity, of those present with Denikin. But there were also direct accusations against those present, that they had exchanged information with acquaintances who lived in outlying areas, Kiev, for example, which were not under the control of the Central Soviet authorities. In other words, this used to be Russia, let's say, but then in the interests of world revolution, we ceded this one piece to Germany. And people continued to exchange letters. How are you doing there, Ivan Ivanich? Here's how things are going with us. N.M. Kishkin, a member of the Central Committee of the Cadets, was so brazen as to try to justify himself right from the defendant's bench. A man doesn't want to be blind. He tries to find out everything he can about what's going on everywhere. To find out everything about what's going on everywhere? He doesn't want to be blind? Well, all one can say is that the accuser correctly described their actions as treason. Treason to Soviet power. But their most heinous acts were something else again. In the midst of the Civil War, they wrote books, composed memoranda and projects. Yes, as experts in constitutional law, financial science, economic relationships, the system of justice and education, they wrote works. And as one might easily guess, their works were not based on earlier works by Lenin, Trotsky and Bukharin. Professor Kotliarevsky wrote on the federal structure of Russia. V.I. Stempkovsky on the agrarian question, no doubt without collectivization. V.S. Muralevich on education in the future Russia. N.N. Vinogradsky on economics. And the great biologist N.K. Kultsov, who never received anything from the motherland except persecution and execution, allowed all those bourgeois bigshots to get together in his institute for their discussions. N.D. Kondratiev was included here also. In 1931 he was condemned once and for all in connection with TKP, the fictitious Working Peasants' Party. Our accuser's heart jumps right out of our chest, outrunning the sentence. Well, what punishment was adequate for these assistants to the general? Just one, of course, to be shot. That was not merely what the accuser demanded, it was the sentence of the tribunal. Alas, it was later commuted to concentration camp until the end of the Civil War. And indeed, the defendant's guilt consisted in the fact that they hadn't sat in their own corners sucking on their quarter pound of bread, that they had talked things over and reached agreements as to what the state structure should be after the fall of the Soviet regime. In contemporary scientific language, this is known as the study of the alternative possibility. The voice of the accuser thundered, but we hear some kind of crack in it, as if his eyes were searching the rostrum, looking for another piece of paper. A quotation, perhaps. Give it to him on tiptoe. Quick, quick. Give him one at random, from some other trial. It's not important. Wasn't this the one, Nikolai Vasilievich Krylenko? For us, the concept of torture inheres in the very fact of holding political prisoners in prison. So that's it. It is torture to keep political prisoners in prison. And the accuser said so. What a generous view. A new jurisprudence is arising. And further. Struggle against the Tsarist government was second nature to them, the politicals. And not to struggle against Tsarism was something of which they were incapable. What's that? They were incapable of not studying alternative possibilities? Perhaps thinking was first nature to the intellectual. Alas, through stupidity, they had shoved the wrong quotation at him. Now, wasn't that a mix-up for you?